Good evening. Be opening to Ephesians chapter 5, please. We're continuing to work our way through Paul's letter, and I'll share with you a moment of fear I had today. You have been feeding me so well that I got back to our room, and I was a bit worried, what if I try and put my suit on and it doesn't fit after all this? So I think if this is to happen again, I might buy a suit a size up just in case something happens. But I appreciate your hospitality and your warmth and your welcome to me and my family. So we're continuing Paul's thought that he begins in chapter 4 and verse 1 about the Christian needing to walk in a particular way, a way that is worthy of being called by God for the mission of God as it's been revealed in Christ. So last night, he looks at a couple of contrasts about an older way of life among the Gentiles and things that we put off, things like anger or lying, of stealing, you know, things that we take out of our lives and then things that we put in, things like edification and of truth-telling and of hard work, so that we are faithful Christians, that we're faithful to Christ. And what Paul is concerned about in this section, both in chapter 4 that we looked at previously and then into chapter 5 and 6, is firming up Christian boundaries. And you and I understand that because we know not everybody in our society lives like a Christian or wants to even live like a Christian. So it becomes important to know, well, what sorts of things are acceptable for a Christian and what things need to be kept aside. So he's concerned about the Ephesian audience, though there's not much of an indication that there's sort of one particular thing that he is concerned about, but kind of a general picture. Concerned that the Ephesians might go backwards into darkness rather than staying in the light of Christ. So he's continuing to firm them up and to remind them of who they are meant to be. And he will, in our section this evening, provide for them the example. In the ancient world, sort of a teaching technique that they used and one that we use too, is to give the example, right? So here, whatever you're trying to learn how to do, be a great warrior, be a great orator, here is the example of the person and sort of follow in their footsteps. And we do that too, right? You know, if we wanted somebody to learn how to play basketball, we'd show them clips of Michael Jordan or James Harden and say, you know, do what they're doing, right? Sort of imitate them. Or if we wanted to teach somebody how to write, to write a play, we might say, well, read some Shakespeare, or how to write poetry, we might say, well, look at David's Psalms. Or if we wanted someone to learn how to play music, I would play them Bob Dylan. And now, maybe I'm alone in that, but, right, you give someone the example to follow. Well, Paul is going to do that about following God, about living as this child of light, and the example he would put before them is Jesus, right? Here is the one who has done that, now imitate and follow him. So by doing that, you remain in the light and you stay out of the darkness. And that's sort of his overall goal. So our task for this evening, Paul will again reiterate some of the darkness that is around them and some of the dark things that might be more likely than others, I guess, to pull them backwards into their old way of life. So he will warn them about that, as well as telling them about what it would mean to look and live like a child of light. And just sort of so it doesn't catch you off guard at the end, the last lessons that we've been doing, we've sort of done kind of a final application section at the end. These will be sort of traced throughout so that doesn't surprise you. All right, well, let's look at the first couple of verses here of chapter 5. The first 14, Paul will talk to us about walking in the way of love in a world that is often unloving. So beginning in verse 1. Therefore, be imitators of God as beloved children, and walk in love, just as Christ also loved you and gave himself up for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God as a fragrant aroma. But immorality, or any impurity, or greed, must not even be named among you, as is proper among saints. And there must be no filthiness and silly talk or coarse jesting, which are not fitting, but rather giving of thanks. For this you know with certainty, that no immoral or impure person or covetous man who is an idolater has an inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God. Let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of these things the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. Therefore, do not be partakers with them. For you were formerly darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of light. For the fruit of the light consists in all goodness and righteousness and truth, trying to learn what is pleasing to the Lord. Do not participate in the unfruitful deeds of darkness, but instead even expose them. For it is disgraceful even to speak of the things which are done by them in secret. But all these things become visible when they are exposed by the light. For everything that becomes visible is light. For this reason it says, awake, sleeper, and arise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you. So we'll pause it there. So he elevates here, as he is instructing them to be children of light, he elevates the virtue of love as the highest virtue, the highest trait that they could be imitating. So he tells them to imitate God, to be like God. And there's perhaps a lot of directions we might want to go with that, or might think Paul would take us to be like God in his holiness. 1 Peter would lead us in that direction. Be like God as God is holy, or justice. Be like God as he is just. Paul, though, here stresses, be like God as God is loving. That as a virtue or a of imitation of God that ought to be central to who the Christian is, somebody who loves in all things. But that love needs to be qualified. It needs to be explained. Because it's not the love that you and I probably just saw a bunch of a month ago during Valentine's Day, of sort of sweet flowery cards and some chocolates and these sort of token gestures that we give to show something like love or a gift that we might dole out. Nor is it the flippant way that we say love, like, I really loved that movie or I really love that restaurant. This is the love that Paul defines by the cross. Right? What does love look like? It looks like the love of Christ when he gave himself on the cross. A real, concrete, sturdy love of action. A love that sacrifices for the others. So when we want to know what is love, what does love look like? It looks like Jesus. And it looks like Jesus primarily when he's on the cross on our behalf. And so you and I know what love is there. And we also experience love there. I mean, that is the time in which we have truly been loved in its fullest and most complete and robust sense was Jesus on the cross. So then the Christians here are told, and us by extension, you know what love is because you know what Jesus did. Therefore, be like that. Be like Jesus in his loving sacrifice. So when that is there at the heart of who we are, when we're imitating God and his love, then I think you start to go back to chapter 4 and Paul's concern with unity, right, and keeping Christians together, that when love is in its rightful place at the center of who we are, a love that looks like Jesus, then the unity falls accordingly and comes after that. So he tells us, be people of love. But for them and for us, we live in a world that is absent of a lot of love, right? A world that is often unloving in most of the things that it does. So he describes for them in their world what an unloving set of attributes look like. And so he goes into things like immorality. And he uses sort of a blanket term there to talk about immorality or impurity, which it speaks to a wide variety of sexual sins. So it could be fornication, it could be adultery, it could be incest, it could be polygamy, it could be prostitution, it could be any number of things that were common in the Roman world. So he says, don't be people like that, instead be people like love. And this would, I mean, you know, if people in the wider world were listening to this being said by Paul or being read out loud, it would be astonishing to them because they had a very loose sexual ethic, right? And that a lot of things were permissible. Husbands were allowed to commit adultery with no consequence, right? You could go down to the temple and engage in any sorts of the explicit festivals that they would have. And even it's preserved. I'm sure you've heard of Pompeii, the city that was had the volcano erupt and it was covered in ash. And so it preserved a lot of what was going on in Pompeii. And what they have found in going through the ruins is a lot of sexually explicit imagery throughout the entire city. It was common. It was not thought to be a problem. It was encouraged all around you. But here Paul says, no, that's not emblematic of a person of love. That's the way of darkness. So he tells them, right, don't slide back into that. And then he continues in this train of thought, I think, with the to warn them about being people of greed. Now, we, I think, most readily attach greed to money or possessions, right? Wanting sort of more. But what underlies that greed is an insatiable desire, an unquenchable desire for more things, right? That it's never enough money, it's never a big enough home or enough cars or toys. There always must be more, and so we're greedy for it. And that could be applied to money appropriately. It could be applied to things like fame or recognition, where we're greedy for recognition from others. Or it could be contextually here, a sort of sexual greed that is always wanting more, that's not satisfied, say, with a man and a woman spouse, but needs, you know, more exploits and more outlets. And so he warns them to not be people of greed. He also warns them again, like last night, about immoral speech. There in verse 4, no filthiness or silly talk or coarse jesting, which are not fitting, but instead to be people of thanks. So there are, again, any number of things, especially when you tie it back into chapter 4, that he could be referring to. I mean, sort of jokes that coarse jesting, which treats other people as objects, right? Or this sort of sexual looseness that gets joked about, and by joking about it becomes less of a taboo, but becomes normalized. Or any of the other things we talked about, unfair criticisms and tearing people down, or racism and things like that. He warns them again not to be people who have this immoral speech. Now, what runs through all three of those is they are unloving. Each of those means you do not love the other person, right? If to be sexually immoral is not about love, it's about self-gratification. It's about getting what you want. If you're a person of greed, it's not a concern for other people or your community around you. It's about what you want. Or this same type of coarse jesting or making fun of other people is not about them and what they need. It's about you and what makes you feel good and more powerful. So he says those things are the way of darkness because they do not reflect the love of God seen on the cross. And therefore they have no part in who the Christian is. And you and I should not tolerate those things among ourselves or among people that consider themselves Christians who rebelliously continue to cling to them, sort of unashamedly cling to it. But say, no, that is the way of darkness and not of love, and we will not stand for that. I want to pause a bit, take a bit of a side alley, and questioning why Paul would go from the most beautiful thing you could talk about, the love of Christ and his sacrifice, right, the most beautiful image that could possibly come into our minds, he goes straight from that to the sordid depths of human sin and immorality. And we might want to sort of caution Paul and say, well, Paul, that's not really nice conversation for polite company. You know, Paul, we don't really talk about those things in public. You know, those are sort of shameful, and we shouldn't be speaking about those things in front of other people. And yet, Paul unashamedly goes right into the middle of the discussion. Doesn't temper his speech or hide that back and say, well, it's not appropriate for us to talk about as a church. He says, no, that it must be talked about because Christians must know the dangers that are out there. We have to be open and honest with each other to say, no, here is where the struggle is, right? We don't do ourselves any favor or the people that we love any favors when we keep our mouth closed because we're ashamed or embarrassed to talk about it. And Paul goes right into it to say, no, here is the danger, understand it, and be ready for it. And I'll say, if we are ashamed or embarrassed to talk about sexuality, I will tell you who is not ashamed to talk about it. And it's the rest of the world. They will talk about it. And they'll talk about it with your children. And they'll put it on television. And they'll put it in the music. And everywhere else, right? It will be out there, right? And they will hear it. And they will be confronted by it. Now, are we merely playing defense to that? Or have we gone on the offense? To say, let's think about what it means as Christians to think about our bodies and sexuality and love and what all of that means. So if embarrassment, I'm afraid, will not cut it for us. So, he goes from the cross to talk about sexuality. Why? First, I would say, because the cross reminds us that God cares about our bodies. And I'm afraid we lose some of that because we envision this as kind of the bodies that we find ourselves in or the world as an unfortunate place to be for the moment, right? And I, you know, am sort of Xing days off the calendar until I get to leave here and go to a far-off heaven, and that my body is just sort of a temporary impairment that I have. But think of the message that is sent by the cross, because there on the cross, you have God taking on a human body. If you think back to Genesis, we were created in human bodies, not as an accident, not God making a mistake somewhere, but he said, no, you will be like this with a body on an earth to work. So when you look at Jesus on the cross, God in flesh, crucified, going then into a tomb, and you know where his body wasn't abandoned? If the body didn't matter to God, if it was sort of an unnecessary entrapment for a time, Jesus' body would still be in the tomb. But his body was redeemed, bought back, and transformed, showing us again, even more, God cares about our bodies. And he cares about what we do with our bodies because it is our bodies that are being redeemed. And that includes sexually. He cares about what happens there. And so it's important for us when we think about, well, what am I going to do with my body? Not to think of it as my own. That's sort of a common expression, right? It's my body to do with as I want. But to see it as something created by and with a particular intention and purpose from God. So the cross reminds us of that. Secondly, the cross reminds us that God heals our brokenness. The things in our life that are torn apart. And that can a lot of the time be sexually. You know, either we have committed things in our past that we're ashamed of, transgressions, that things that we have done that we have regretted. It may be that we have suffered from an abuse in the past, and our lives are still suffering from the consequences of that. It could be a reminder of all the things that are a part of us, or even sort of a standard that we put on ourselves about the rest of the world. You know, do I live up to some sort of standard of attractiveness from the world? And because I feel like I don't, my life is somehow less valuable or has less worth because we've based ourselves on something other than God. But what the cross reminds us of, all the things about us that are broken and torn apart and that we struggle with, that we wrestle with, find their healing in Jesus. And they find their healing there. And it envelops us in the love of God and tells us, you are worthy. Not because you meet some sort of physical perfection. I went like this as if this is showing you what physical perfection is. That's clearly not the case. Why did you laugh? You're supposed to say, no, Jared, you're fine. Whatever sort of tension that we feel in our lives because we don't feel attractive or we've got some sin that we're ashamed of, the cross envelops us in the love of God and says, no, you know you are worthy. You know you are valuable. Because Jesus died on the cross for you too. That's where your worth and your value comes from. Finally, the cross reminds us what true love looks like. True love is not simply the physical interaction between two individuals, or something akin to free love, right? Sort of having as many partners as you want, and we call that free love. Real love is not indulging in fantasy through romance novels or through pornography. That is not love. And if we continue to pursue those things, thinking that they will fill the gap in our lives that is looking for love, then we will merely delude ourselves and walk in darkness. Because what the cross shows us about love at its very core is about sacrifice. It is about the other person. Okay, it is giving. It's not taking. It's not about getting what I want or my gratification. It is about giving to somebody else. That's what the cross shows us about love. A real relationship, a real sacrifice. So then you take sexuality and you put that within the purpose of two individuals in a lifelong commitment towards one another in which they are sacrificing for one another, in which they care for one another. Then you have something beautiful created by God that expresses real love. And we need to remember that because we're not getting to the marriage section until tomorrow night. But remember how Paul has been stressing that here, because when he gets to marriage at the end of chapter 5, all these thoughts ought to still be fresh in our mind. So the cross tells us what real love looks like. And the lies and the myths and the delusions that we tell ourselves about love or our society tells us about love are wholly inadequate, if not dangerous, when we allow them to go unchecked. All right, let's go back on track into Ephesians. So then, living as people of light. Because we are people of light, and we are going to walk as children of light, that means you cannot go back into the darkness. That there will be things in our world that you and I cannot do, even if they were the things that we used to do, right? Before we became children of light. And even if society continues to say, well, no, you should really be doing this and going here with me and doing this and saying that, that we are to remember we are people of light, not darkness. But through that, notice how he begins talking about shining a light. Okay, sort of beginning there in verse 11, right? Exposing the things of darkness, being visible in verse 13, right? To exposing the darkness that is around us. What that tells us, as Paul thinks about what the Christian life looks like, it is not you and I floating off to a distant planet somewhere saying, well, the world sure is a mess, and I don't want anything to do with it because it's such a mess, so I'm just going to get out of here. Or we're going to wander off into the desert somewhere and have our own private Christian community. Though even there, that might not work out as well as we would hope. So Paul doesn't envision Christians, knowing that they are children of light, not engaging in darkness, leaving the world behind. Okay, abandoning, but he says, instead, shine your light. Okay, expose the things that you see. That could work out, I think, in two ways. One, it could be exposing the things of darkness by calling the world's attention to its evil, right? Showing the world these are the things that are happening that should not be occurring and need to be given up, right? Because there is one true Lord of the world, and it's Jesus. Therefore, all that we do and say and all the actions that we have ought to reflect him. And so we call people's attention to it. Okay, when we see abuse, and we see hate, and we see the immorality, that we say, no, it ought not to be that way. And that may be one avenue to expose it. I think, though, the primary avenue Paul envisions here is you expose it by living as a child of light. Okay, by living faithfully to Jesus, you show the world there is an alternative. That whatever schemes they've developed, right, whatever way of life they think is best, the church shows them, well, no, there's another way. You don't have to go that route. You can go this route and see how much better you are for it. So you shine a light by living a life of the love of Jesus, by showing people there is an alternative. And when they see the alternative, they then realize how dark their world really is because they've seen the light. It's one thing to say that. You know, it's one thing to find evil in the world and go to Facebook or go to Twitter and you know, write about how evil Hollywood is or how corrupt the government is. It's one thing to do that, and that's perhaps the easier route. It's a whole nother thing to actually show people by your life that there is an alternative. So when the world looks in on us, okay, when they peer behind the curtain, they look at the church, do they see an alternative life, right? Do they see an alternative life built around love, or do they see merely another group of people who have just as much division and animosity and greed and selfishness and divisiveness and hatred and all those sorts of immoral, dark things, but now they're just in a group that calls themselves Christians. So do they see an alternative in the way that we live? So if we're going to critique the darkness, if we're going to call out to it, our house has to be in order first. And I get sometimes troubled with prayers that I hear that sort of pray for the parts of the rest of the world that need to, right, sort of give up certain things or be confronted by their evil and change, and yet I hear very little about God help us to change and to be more like people of light, as if, well, of course we've got it right and it's everybody else who's wrong. But there are things in our lives that need to be ironed out as we grow to imitate Christ more and more. So Paul says, with Jesus as the vision of this, right, Jesus as the exemplification of it, to live a life of love. And then our final section, picking up in verse 15. Therefore, be careful how you walk, not as unwise men, but as wise, making the most of your time, because the days are evil. So then do not be foolish, but understand what the will of the Lord is. And do not get drunk with wine, for that is dissipation, but be filled with the Spirit, speaking to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody with your heart to the Lord, always giving thanks for all the things in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ to God, even the Father, and be subject to one another in the fear of Christ. So a couple of things to note from here. Paul does what's a sort of a typical Jewish move to create two pathways. You have two options. So if you like, you were to go to the Proverbs, you see it in the Proverbs a lot. You know, there are two ways you can go. And you see it in Jesus, where he talks about the narrow way and the wide way. Sort of simplifying things down, you've got two directions, and which one will you pick? So Paul encourages us to take note of our life, right? To think about the way that we live. He says, be careful how you walk, consider how you walk, walk in wisdom, not as someone who is unwise. Because he tells us the days are evil. And that's sort of this Jewish apocalyptic language of there is this great conflict that history is surging forward to a particular point, that there's a war going on, right? There's a battle that's taking place. Therefore, live your life recognizing the struggle that is out there, recognizing the struggle that has come with the evil age. Will you go the way of wisdom, or will you go the way of unwisdom and evil and foolishness and all that might be tempting there? And to know wisdom, right? Well, what is the wise path? He says you know wisdom when you follow God. When you follow him, right, verse 17, you understand what the will of the Lord is. That is the wise path. But what I appreciate about Paul, Paul even seems to recognize in there that that's not always easy. So verse 10, trying to learn or discerning what is pleasing to the Lord, or verse 17, but having to understand what the will of the Lord is. And this is to come to the reality that you and I have probably faced at some point, and that when you open the Bible, you don't have 1,000 lists of just straight rules that touch every situation, every person, every decision you might come across. You don't have sort of the nice, neat package that you could look up the rules for. So it takes discernment. It takes thinking through. Here's a situation I don't find exactly in Scripture, so what do I do with it? And with the center of that being, right, as you know, society changes and new problems come in, and how do I think about it and how do I use it? What rules and barriers need to be in place? At the center of each of those, at the center of every decision, is the recognition of Jesus as Lord. Whatever decision we make must be consistent with the claim that Jesus rules the world and that our decision fits that. And it will take discernment and prayer, and that's why we have Christians who meet together, right? We don't make those decisions on our own. We make them together as Christians. And so we think through and we discern what is the appropriate way that is consistent with a life following Jesus. And giving the recognition that the world is evil, he encourages us to be filled with the Spirit. So he moves, and this is, you know, verse 18, do not get drunk with wine, but be filled with the Spirit. Seems like a lopsided scale, right? Those things we wouldn't think are compatible with each other or need to even be put in opposition. You know, obviously drunkenness is wrong and, you know, being filled with the Spirit is right. So why even need to bring that up, Paul? And here's where some of the cultural background comes into play. You and I probably find it pretty easy to go through your week without drunkenness. Now, I know some people struggle with that more than others. But you don't have to participate in that to participate in most of your life. But that's not necessarily the case for the Ephesians, because at the center of all of their civic life were festivals, were these great parties. And that could be religious. You're going to go down to the Temple of Diana in Ephesus, and there's going to be a big party with lots of wine flowing. Now, you probably shouldn't be at the Temple of Diana anyway, but or even in your trade guild. So you're a craftsman, you're a carpenter, you're a tent maker. You would have a professional guild together that would meet to have festivals and parties. And as a part of that would be lots of alcohol flowing and lots of drunkenness. So that if you wanted to participate in the economic life, you would need to go to those parties. So there would be a real pull back there. I mean, a real temptation to say, look, I've got to make a living. I need to compromise on this. Paul cuts them off and says, no, don't waste your time getting drunk. clouding your mind with alcohol. Instead, be filled with the Spirit, because the days are evil and you want to be wise and not unwise. So be filled with the Spirit. And the way that is written, it's not a one-time act that you are filled with the Spirit. It is a continual act of being filled with the Spirit, something that needs attention, that won't just happen once in your life and you get to ride the wave throughout, that it's something that needs attention. Now, I want to, there are two sort of ways to look at from 18 down through 21, that Paul tells us, be filled with the Spirit, and because you are filled with the Spirit, you will engage in the activities of 19, 20, and 21. And that may very well be correct. Another way of looking at this, based on how the Greek is written, and one I will submit to you to consider, is that Paul is then telling us how you are filled by the Spirit. So he tells them, be filled by the Spirit. Well, okay, Paul, how does that happen? And then he tells us, and this is sort of helpful for me, just to kind of remind us, and here's where I enjoy taking letters as a whole, like we've been doing. Paul is not arguing in verse 19 against the things that we argue about with instrumental music. That's not why Paul has put that there. He's got a, sort of a bigger argument at play with this notion of being filled with the Spirit. So, Paul says, don't cloud your mind with drunkenness because you need to be wise. If you're going to be wise, you need to be filled with the Spirit. Well, Paul, how am I filled with the Spirit? He says, speaking to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody with your heart to the Lord. That in our worship, we are filled and strengthened by the Spirit to go into the world to be people of light, people with strong, firm convictions, able to discern the right way to live, the right way to make decisions, and we are filled through our worship. And this, I think, fits when we've seen this throughout Ephesians. Paul will use temple imagery. You're being knitted together as a temple, and that sort of language being used throughout. In the worship of the temple in 2 Chronicles 5, you see in their worship the Spirit of God filling the temple. So that sort of language would fit if that's how Paul is using it. So that our worship becomes not an obligation. I don't want the elders to get on to me for not showing up, so I better be there. That it becomes the way you and I are reinvigorated, we're filled, we're strengthened to go be people of light in the world. And when we neglect that, when we say it's not important for me to come back Sunday night or Wednesday night, then how important is it for us to walk and live by the Spirit, to have a life of wisdom? Secondly, in our worship, but also in our gratitude, always giving thanks for all things in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ to God, even the Father. We are filled by the Spirit when we spend our time in thanks to God, when we express our gratitude. And I mean, surveying the book of Ephesians, Paul has given us a lot to be grateful for. Read back chapters 1, 2, and 3. There's a lot there in those texts to be excited about and thankful for God. So when we live a life of gratitude towards God, not of grumbling, not of complaining, not of wishing things could be different for me, but of gratitude towards God, we are then filled and strengthened by the Spirit. Likely those two make sense to us. Worship, gratitude, that's me and God, you know, my relationship and my strength from Him. And then he throws us the curveball in verse 21. It also comes by our submission to others. You and I become filled by the Spirit when we submit ourselves, when we defer to others. Again, for Paul, the church is not incidental. It's not an accident. It's not this thing tacked on at the end, but it's part of our Christian life. And this fits nicely, him coming back to this here, with the train of thought that he began in the earlier chapters about Jew and Gentile, the unity there. For that unity to exist and flourish requires Christians saying, I will defer and sacrifice for the other person. And you again find the example of that in Jesus. You find Jesus sacrificing and submitting to the needs of others rather than what he might have wanted or what he thought was best in his interests. So we submit, and by submitting, become filled by the Spirit. Paul does not allow us here to see the Spirit as you know, if God is Father, Son, and Spirit, we think, you know, there's a hierarchy of Father, Son, and Spirit is a distant third, right? He doesn't get much conversation on our part, at least my part, right? That's something I am having to work through. But Paul sees it as fundamental to being able to walk and live in a dark age as a child of light with the power and the strength and the filling by the Spirit, that the Spirit must be what guides us in this life, not ourselves, not sort of the larger cultural picture of the world, that it must be the Spirit that guides us, not ourselves. So now it's the time for reflection. Does my life reflect a person being guided by the Spirit of God? Simple question to ask, harder to answer, and harder to change. Does my life reveal a person being guided by the Spirit of God, or a person who is doing what they want selfishly or the larger cultural desires? And if I'm finding there a weakness, well, my life doesn't look like a person following God. Maybe in some ways it does, but in other ways it doesn't. Then I need to think, well, am I doing the things that Paul tells me to do to strengthen that, right? Am I worshiping? Am I expressing my gratitude and thanksgiving to God? Am I submitting myself to others? And if we sort of ignore those things and say, well, I want sort of all the benefits, right? I want the wise life, and I want the walking in light, and I want the healthy relationship with God, but I don't want to do the things that is necessary to achieve that, then I can't get mad at God and say, well, God is ignoring me, or God has abandoned me, or God isn't helping me here, because I am not doing the things God told me to do to be strong, to be strengthened, to mature in my faith, but am merely remaining an infant. So then let's take that question a step further. Does my life look like a person being guided by the Spirit? Well, what's our worship like? What's my thanksgiving to God like? I mean, do I spend time in the day, and I don't, do I spend time in the day expressing my thanksgiving to God in a way other than, well, it's a meal and I better say something nice about my meal, and so here's my one sentence of gratitude about the food, right? Is it more than that? Is it a whole life of thanksgiving? And does my life look like service to others? Is that a part of who I am? Submitting myself to their needs. So in conclusion, Paul challenges us here to be people of both wisdom and love. Again, that truth and love combination together. Not just wisdom, not just love, but both of them as they are expressed by Jesus on the cross. And that will require you and I will have to give things up. You and I won't be able to achieve some sort of personal freedom where I get to make all the decisions about my life by myself and what I want. Or I might have to give up elements of my own ambition. You know, I always thought my life of achieving this goal, right? This is where I always wanted to end up, and maybe that must be sacrificed for the needs of the church. And so God is calling us to quite a rigorous way of life. A lot of challenges there, a lot of difficult decisions and choices to make there. But the thing about this God, this is not a distant, far-off God. It's not a great universal policeman who gives out a bunch of rules and then just sits up there waiting for us to mess up so he can punish us. Because this is the same God who calls us to this higher calling, who took on flesh to give himself on the cross. That's the God that then tells you and me to walk as a child of light. He's the one who's shown us what real humanity looks like, and it's he that calls us. So will you and I walk in the light? Will we sacrifice what needs sacrificing? Will we give up what needs to be given up? Will we take on what needs to be taken on? And it's this God from the cross that cries out in his love and his concern for us, his desire to save us and redeem us, that is calling you now. And maybe it's time for you to submit your life to him, to recognize that he runs the world, that he stands as Lord, and it's time my life becomes secondary to his will. Or maybe, as we all are from time to time, have looked more like a child of darkness than a child of light. That we've become complacent, we've become lax and negligent about the things we ought to have been doing, we've let slip things that were important so that we could pursue our own ambition. Maybe it's time to put ourselves again at the feet of Jesus, to ask for his forgiveness, and to receive the strength and encouragement of the congregation, you know, to be lifted up. Because that's what we're here for. If we were all perfect, you wouldn't need a church. And so if you're prepared this evening to come forward, to take care of the things that need to be taken care of, we invite you to come forward as we stand and sing.